4. Jeffrey made 3 other appearances that first day. The first came at one of the high school fields during an 11th grade gym class. Most of the students were playing soccer, but about a dozen were playing football. Because they were on the varsity and the gym teacher happened to be the football coach, the star quarterback, Brian Dennehy, wound up and threw a 60-yarder to his favorite receiver, James Hands Down, who was streaking a fly pattern down the sideline. But the ball never quite reached Hands. Just as he was about to cradle it in his big, brown, loving mitts, it vanished. By the time he recovered from the shock, a little kid was weaving upfield through the varsity football players. Nobody laid a paw on him. When the kid got down to the soccer field, he turned and punted the ball. It sailed back over the up-looking gym classers, spiraling more perfectly than anything Brian Dennehy had ever thrown. And it landed in the outstretched hands of still-stunned Hands Down. Then the kid ran off. There was one other thing, something that all of them saw, but no one believed until they compared notes after school that day. Up until the punt, the kid had done everything with one hand. He had to, because in his other hand was a book. Chapter 5. Later on the first day, there was a commotion in the West End. At 803 Oriole Street, to be exact, at the backyard of 803 Oriole, to be exacter, this, of course, was the infamous address of Finsterwald. Kids stayed away from Finsterwald the way old people stay away from Saturday afternoon matinees at a $2 movie. And what would happen to a kid didn't stay away? That was a question best left unanswered. Suffice it to say that occasionally, even today, if some poor, rackety, nicotine-stained wretch is seen shuffling through town, word will spread that this once was a bright, happy, normal child who had the misfortune of blundering onto Finsterwald's property. That's why, if you valued your life, you never chased a ball into Finsterwald's backyard. Finsterwald's backyard was a graveyard of tennis balls and baseballs and footballs and frisbees and model airplanes and one-way boomerangs. That's why his front steps were the only unsat-on front steps in town, and why no paper kid would ever deliver there, and why no kid on a snow day would ever shovel that sidewalk, not for a zillion dollars. So it was late afternoon and screams were coming from Finsterwald's. Who? What? Why? The screamer was a boy whose name is lost to us, for after this day he disappears from the pages of history. We believe he was about 10 years old. Let's call him Arnold Jones. Arnold Jones was being hoisted in the air above Finsterwald's backyard fence. The hoisters were 3 or 4 high school kids. This was one of the things they did for fun. Arnold Jones had apparently forgotten one of the cardinal rules of survival in the West End. Never let yourself be near Finsterwald's and high school kids at the same time. So there's Arnold Jones, held up by all these hands, flopping and kicking and shrieking like some poor Aztec human sacrifice about to be tossed off a pyramid. No, no, please, he pleads, please. So, of course, they do it. The high schoolers dump him into the yard, and now they back off, no longer laughing, just watching the back door of the house, the windows, the dark green shades. As for Arnold Jones, he clams up the instant he hits the ground. He's on his knees now, all hunched and puckered. His eyes goggle at the back door, at the doorknob. He's paralyzed, a mouse in front of the yawning maw of a python. Now, after a minute or two of breathless silence, one of the high schoolers thinks he hears something. He whispers, "Listen." Another one hears it, a faint, tiny noise, a rattling, a chittering, a chattering, and getting louder. Yes, chattering teeth. Arnold Jones's teeth. They're chattering like snare drums. And now, as if his mouth isn't big enough to hold the chatter, the rest of his body joins in. First, it's a buzz-like trembling, then the shakes, and finally, it's as if every bone inside him is clamoring to get out. A high schooler squawks, "He's got the Finster Woolies!" "Yeah, yeah," they yell, and they stand there, cheering and clapping. Years later, the high schooler's accounts differ. One says the kid from nowhere hopped the fence, hopped it without ever laying a hand on it to boist himself over. Another says the kid just opened the back gate and strolled on in. Another swears it was a mirage, some sort of hallucination, possibly caused by evil emanations surrounding 803 Oriole Street. Real or not, they all saw the same kid, not much bigger than Arnold Jones, raggedy, flap-soled sneakers, book in one hand. They saw him walk right up to Arnold, and they saw Arnold look up at him and faint dead away. Such a bad case of the Finster Woolies did Arnold have that his body kept shaking for half a minute after he conked out. The Phantom Samaritan stuck the book between his teeth, crouched down, hoisted Arnold Jones' limp carcass over his shoulder, and hauled him out of there like a sack of flour. Unfortunately, he chose to put Arnold down at the one spot in town as bad as Finsterwald's backyard, namely Finsterwald's front steps. When Arnold came to and discovered this, he took off like a horsefly from a swatter. As the stupefied high schoolers were leaving the scene, they looked back. They saw the kid, cool times 10, stretch out on the forbidden steps and open his book to read. Chapter 6. About an hour later, Mrs. Valerie Pickwell twanged open her back screen door, stood on the step, and whistled. As whistles go, Mrs. Pickwell's was one of the all-time greats. It reeled in every Pickwell kid for dinner every night. Never was a Pickwell kid ever late for dinner. It's a record that will probably stand forever. The whistle wasn't loud. It wasn't screechy. It was a simple two-note job. One high note, one low. To an outsider, it wouldn't sound all that special. But to the ears of a Pickwell kid, it was magic. Somehow, it had the ability to slip through the slush of 5 o'clock noises to reach its targets. So, from the dump, from the creek, from the tracks, from Red Hill, it ran the Pickwell kids for dinner, all 10 of them. And to that, the parents, Baby Diddy, Grandmother and Grandfather Pickwell, Great-Grandfather Pickwell, and a down-and-out taxi driver who Mr. Pickwell was helping out. The Pickwells were always helping out somebody. All that, and you had what Mrs. Pickwell called her small nation. Only a ping-pong table was big enough to seat them all, and that's what they ate around. Dinner was spaghetti. In fact, every third night dinner was spaghetti. When dinner was over and they were all bringing their dirty dishes to the kitchen, Dominic Pickwell said to Duke Pickwell, "Who's that kid?"
"What kid?"
said Duke. "The kid next to you at the table."
"I don't know."
I thought Donald knew him.
I don't know him, said Donald. I thought Dion knew him.
Never saw him, said Dion. I figured it was Deidre's new boyfriend. Deidre kicked Dion in the shins. Duke checked back in the living room.
He's gone.
The Pickle kids dashed out the back door to the top of Rako Hill. They scanned the railroad tracks. There he was, passing Red Hill, a book in his hand. He was running, passing the spear field now, and the Pickle kids had to blink and squint and shade their eyes to make sure they were seeing right. Because the kid wasn't running the cinders alongside the tracks or the wooden ties. No, he was running where the Pickwells themselves, where every other kid had only ever walked, on the steel rail itself.